In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps in the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening. Welcome back to our exploration of the nature of reality as understood in the Buddhist tradition, from the Buddha to today. And tonight we dive into the second of the two main commentators on Nagarjuna's presentation, named Bhavaviveka, often called Bhavaviveka until a few decades or a decade or so ago. People decided they didn't need the other V. They could conserve some letters. Anyway, so we have this wonderful text by him, which is quite enticing. But first, I've asked Christopher to give another introduction to the man himself, Bhavaviveka. Please.
Avi Veka, known by a number of names. So, as Derek mentioned, we have Bhavaviveka. We also have Bhavya, Bhagavadveka, Bhavin. Those are some of his monikers. So, he was born in, we think, South India. Some Chinese sources say North India, but general consensus is South India, sometime in the 6th century. And seems as though he was born in a royal family, some sort of South Indian royalty, which may be part of what allowed him to rise to a certain level of prominence, unlike his colleague Buddhapalita. So the 6th century was a time in which we often think of Madhyamaka as appearing around the end of, well, I guess around 100 BC, and that is true, but it was very small for a number of years, and wasn't really until around the year 500 of the Common Era that Madhyamaka started being a more influential force in the Indian scene. And so this was a period of a lot of creativity of how we were going to get these teachings out there. So Bhavaviveka may have been one of a number of so-called itinerant monks who would go around and debating anyone who would meet them. This is a scholar, Malcolm Eccle, who describes the period as one of unusual creativity and ferment in the history of history of Indian Buddhist philosophy, and that Mahayana Buddhism was emerging as a vigorous and self-conscious intellectual force, while other early Buddhist traditions from the 18 Nikaya schools opposed the Mahayana movement. So it may be that the emphasis on debate, both within Buddhist schools and non-Buddhist schools, played a large influence in Bhavaviveka's style. A scholar, Ole Kvarnström, I don't know if I'm saying that right. He argues that Bhavaviveka revised and expanded on Nagarjuna's method, and this is a quote, because he was concerned Madhyamaka was in danger of being absorbed or overshadowed by the Yogacara school. He writes that in order to avert these threats, and to bring Madhyamaka philosophy into conformity with the prevalent philosophical requirements of the intellectual milieu in the 6th century, Bhavaveka used logical devices originally formulated by Dignaga and others. So that's a little bit about Bhavaveka. If there's any questions, or we could jump into the reading.
I like that that idea that instead of looking at him as like the one who got it wrong out of him in Buddhapalita, that actually he was a very positive force in the preservation of the Dharma, of Buddha Dharma in India by defending the Buddhist tradition against other traditions. And there was a lot of competition for patronage back in those days.
Yeah, and that competition was very much related to these debates that would happen. So if you win, the kings would often attend the debates, and whoever wins the debate gets their funding.
It's an interesting system, and it would have been fascinating, like a fascinating idea that like these were like the major culture, major events that went on. They didn't have football on Sundays that everybody watched, so this
I
was
think
like.
the other important thing is the realizing that the style of syllogism that we see here is those were sort of the ground rules of the debates. You had to have a position to defend. Famously, Nagarjuna says he has no thesis. So it's tough to debate, engage in a debate whose requirements is defending a thesis when you have none.
Yeah, which indicates he was before that period where there were these formalized, where debates became very formalized and required that structure. And he was basically operating or presenting his texts and views within the monastic Buddhist community, primarily. Ram.
So to be clear, Nagarjuna was before the formalization of these debate styles.
I think so.
So
Yeah, I think.
was that perhaps these formalization, could that have been a reaction to him not having a thesis so that they sort of like get him out of the argument by changing the rules?
Moving the goalposts.
Yeah.
Think
I
what
think what
happened
happened
is
is the
the Nyaya school of Indian philosophy blossomed. And I'm not sure the timing of it, but that's the main opponent to Bhavaveka and so forth, other Buddhist logicians, Dignaga, Dharmakirti. That school became very prevalent. They formalized logical reasoning, and logical reasoning was an enormously powerful force of like explaining and figuring out what's true and what makes sense. And that became enormously popular in the philosophical circles of India, which was India was somewhat uniquely unusual in this sense of like really valuing it, just like Greece was. There were these little pockets of areas in the world, and so Dignaga comes about in that milieu of the Nyaya school of reasoning and comes up with the Buddhist version of that. And the big part of that is like what are valid means of knowledge, of knowing. How do we know that something is true or not? And the Nyaya includes scripture and valid report, like if God tells you, then it's true, you can rely on it. Or if a Brahmin tells you, and the Dignaga dispenses with those two as not being ultimately true, valid means of knowledge, and comes up with a very structured way of presenting the Buddhist Dharma within the logical reasoning system. So So you can see sort of Bhavya, that's like his one of his nicknames, right? For short, Bhavya, saying, well, you know, Buddha, like probably Buddha Palita was criticized by others. We don't really know that. That would be interesting, is that he may have been criticized by others because he didn't conform to their structured debates, as well as Nagarjuna. And so, yeah, that idea that Bhavya took it upon himself to defend the faith, so to speak, makes, or is at least a prevalent supposition for the whole way that this unfolds.
And I think we can also appreciate that there's a real commitment here to trying to be as specific as possible in a really formal sense. That, you know, dispensing with any sort of like poetry and making the language as literal as possible. And we may not agree that it's a successful attempt. But something about that intention to really drill down into what this means and be as specific as possible, I think there's something to that.
Yeah, I think that's huge, and I'm sure, like all of us here, have at times tried to explain the Dharma to people in our circles, our families, our friends, and you know they're speaking a different language and totally coming from a totally different point of view, and it's often very hard to like answer questions or respond to objections that they have because they have such a different framework. And so, you know, you can quickly gain an appreciation for this idea of let's like make things super clear, which is not to say that this text succeeds in that for us, but it's sort of interesting to read this like gobbledygook stuff and think that for some people, this was clear, or it becomes clear. Imagine, you know, translating this is a phenomenal feat because often the opponent and agent and all this stuff, you know, traditionally what's in brackets is not in the text. So the translator has put in all these little words in brackets that are very helpful: thesis, reason, example, you know. And those are not easy to identify. Anyway, so let's dive in. And let's just touch on the very opening, which is nice to set the scene. So on page 21, the translator's homage is pretty standard. And that would be the translator from Sanskrit to Tibetan. And then presumably
So,
this,
Derek, I'm not sure
yeah.
that we all have. I think what
Oh,
we have
thanks so
begins on page
much.
28.
Thanks so much. Second time. Okay, so I'll just read it, but because it's nice introduction. I pay homage to that Buddha who taught the reality of dharmas, which is quite free from conceptual constructions. It pacifies. It is a little bit odd, but I guess the Dharma pacifies all conceptual proliferation and destroys all the defective vision of false opinions. Though reality is not an object of speech, the Buddha taught reality by means of imputation. I'll say that again. Though reality is not an object of speech, the Buddha taught reality by means of imputation. That's a cool statement. So that beings might acquire all levels of existence and spiritual attainment. The Acharya, i.e. Nagarjuna, has taught both the correct verbal expression and the reality of inference, being one of the two main types of valid knowledge in the Buddhist tradition, the other being direct cognition, non-conceptual, as in like it's a fact, like you experience it through your senses. So He taught both verbal expression and the reality of inference and refutation just by means of his text, the Mulla-Viyamaka-Karika. He has stated the doctrine of the perfection of discernment, which is the translator's translation of Prajnaparamita, which puts an end to the net of bad views. That's a bad view. Nevertheless, some of our fellow Buddhists have not understood that text. Therefore, wishing to make them understand, I will explain that Madhyamaka Shastra according to scripture. And just a little bit more, let's see. The Acharya Nagarjuna also understood the Tathagata's doctrine, which is taught by means of terms such as non-origination, which is non-falsity. Then an intense force of joy arose in him, so that he praised the Blessed One according to his doctrine, as he had understood it. And he wished to write this treatise. Because Nagarjuna possessed a mind moistened by the water of compassion, he wished to make those persons for whom inference is important and who wish to understand comprehend this treatise. He wished to make those explanations. So inference is the basis of logical reasoning, right? Thus he said, and the Bhavya quotes Nagarjuna's opening, he who taught dependent origination, which is without cessation, without origination, without annihilation, without permanence, without coming, without going, not something manifold, not one thing, the quiescence of conceptual proliferation, tranquil, is the perfect Buddha. I pay homage to that best of teachers. So that's the famous eight qualities of the true nature of reality that Nagarjuna states, which he pulls from the Prajnaparamita Sutras of without cessation, without origination, without annihilation, without permanence, without. So without the first two, cessation and origination, without annihilation, without permanence, without coming, without going. Not something manifold, not something that's multiple, nor is it one thing. The quiescence, the complete quiescence or quieting or cessation of conceptual proliferation, tranquil or peace. Usually authors say, translators say peace or peaceful. This perfect Buddha, I pay homage to that best of s teachers. Okay, so we start on page 28. So the Acharya Nagarjuna has praised the Blessed One as teaching that very dependent origination that possesses the special characteristics of non-origination, thinking that it would be easy to teach the characteristics of non-cessation and so on after having taught non-origination. Nagarjuna wished to teach non-origination first, thinking it would be easy to teach the characteristics of non-cessation and so on, all of the other characteristics after having taught non-origination as the main one, or as the root. He taught that first. He perceived the conceptual constructions of origination imagined by others. So he understood the way other people understand origination. Some proponents of origination, some who cleave to the idea that things are originated, say that entities originate from themselves. Others say they originate from something else, another. Some say they originate from both, and others that they originate without cause. When one investigates these options by means of reasoning and scripture, one finds that origination cannot be proved in any way. By virtue of his certainty about this fact, Nagarjuna says, not from themselves, not from another, nor from both, nor from no cause, to any originated entities ever exist anywhere. So the main thesis of the whole text is to refute the origination of entities, the idea that things are produced. So thus he sets forth the general thesis. As to this, to begin with, what does not from themselves qualify? Qualifies the second line, do not originated to, sorry, not from themselves qualifies the second line, which is to any originated entities ever exist anywhere. The second line should be connected with each of the negations in the first line. From itself means from its own self. So he just explains the sort of grammatical structure of the first stanza. And then he slips into some logical, basic framework of the logical system. Since the intended meaning of a statement is not established by a mere assertion, just by saying that something is so doesn't prove it. Here the reason is understood to be existence, for from itself is designated in connection with an existing self. So, there's a thesis, there's a reason, and there's an example. That's the basic structure of the logical system. A thesis that states X is Y, and then there's a reason of why X is Y, or A is B, or whatever. And then there's an example. An example is given by virtue of the property to be proved. So the property to be proved is the characteristic or quality of the subject that's contained in the thesis, where we say sound is produced. So sound is the subject, and the property is produced. And so that's to be proved by the reason. And the example supports that. So an example is given by virtue of the property to be proved, the essence of the thesis, and then the proving property is the reason, because it is an example of a subject, of a syllogism, that possesses a property to be proved, and a proving property that are common knowledge to both sides in a debate. So he's just sort of repeating the framework of logical reasoning, so we're all on the same page. The negation, not from themselves, should be regarded as having the meaning of a simple negation, right? And this is key, because it's predominantly negation. This is so because Nagarjuna's intention is to establish non-conceptual wisdom that is endowed with all cognizable objects by negating the net of all conceptual constructions.
I found this to be sort of a provocative statement.
Yeah, that's, I was gonna, yeah, pause there. In what way is that provocative? What does that say?
Well, I just, and what, and what, on what basis is he attributing this attention to Nagarjuna? Doesn't seem like something Nagarjuna says he's setting out to do. And we could just as well make an argument that Nagarjuna's intention is simply to remove false conceptions, not to establish anything whatsoever.
Yeah, so it does seem like that is one example, probably of many, where Bhavya gives an assertion, a positive statement about the whole presentation. Whereas what Chris is saying is it could have been conveyed in the negative instead without putting forward something else to replace it. What else? Mary
Mary Beth?
Beth.
Well, would you just maybe say a little bit about what would be the difference between a cognizable object and a conceptual construction? Because that's kind of what jumped out at me as being important and maybe me not understanding that completely.
Yeah, the statement, this is the, so Chris spoke to the more to the structure of this statement than to the content. The structure being that it's an assertion. And he said it seems more like Nagarjuna undoes any assertions. But let's see if we can unpack what this assertion is that Bhavya is making. So he says that the intent of the text is to establish non-conceptual wisdom, so nirvikalpaka jnana. So that's jnana is wisdom that is beyond conceptual, the conceptual construction. And the word establish is a little uncertain. Is it like, is it implies that he's trying to logically prove it, but it could be more like he's trying to bring it about in his readers, right? By re refuting this and that, he's trying to give rise or create an opening for non-conceptual wisdom to arise. So the weird part of the sentence is non-conceptual wisdom that is endowed with all cognizable objects. So, it seems like this is more like that he's saying that non-conceptual wisdom has the capability of cognizing all objects. That's how I would understand that. It's pretty unclear. By negating the net of conceptual construction, so by clearing away, so kalpana, pana is conception or concept, and by clearing that away, then non-conceptual wisdom understands all objects of knowledge.
Does that mean maybe somehow cognizing is okay, but
Yes.
conceptualizing is not okay?
Exactly, yeah. By clearing
There's
away concept, we actually understand, we're able to cognize objects clearly and directly by clearing away concept. Sorry.
but cognizing objects that don't really exist.
Yeah, so he didn't say that. And so that's the question, because we know the context is that whole framework of do things, whether things exist and in what way they do or don't exist. But cognizable objects really means objects of cognition. And it doesn't really necessarily make any statement about the existential or ontological status of those objects.
So the use of the term object by itself does not imply that.
It's often translate like we're familiar with it, everything to be known, or all
All
things
things
that
that
can be
can be
known.
known. Appearances.
Later
Later
called
called
appearance.
appearance.
Yeah, so that it doesn't have to sound so much like it's affirming the existence of the objects.
I just attempted to Google it. There's not much, but I got scope of one's experience
For which term?
for Jnaya Visaya, cognizable
Vishaya.
objects, Vishaya.
Yeah.
Jnaya
So
Visaya.
Jnana is like one's cognitive capacity, like to know that which can be known, and Vishaya is like within one's, like it's related to Vipassana. It's within one's purview of knowableness, sort of.
I think the point he's making broadly is that non-conceptual wisdom, it ain't some big old nothing. That there's a quality there that is not conceptual.
Yeah, so in the system of of logic of Dignaga, which is not that different from the Nyaya, in that they both accept direct non-conceptual cognition as a valid means of knowledge, of understanding, of experience. And that's the types of that are the six senses. Sorry, the five senses, normal sense, what we call the five external senses, and then the sixth consciousness has some aspect of direct cognition, and then inference obviously happens in the sixth consciousness, but those two are the accepted means of cognition in the Buddhist system of Dignaga. So
Our body consciousness is non-conceptual.
yeah,
Yeah,
all
all
the
the
five
five
sense
sense
consciousness.
consciousness. Right, but for instance, like if you close your eyes and you raise your hands above your head, you know where they are. And you know that without concept. And if you, with your eyes closed, you can then touch like your, say, your right little finger to your left big toe. You can do that with your eyes closed without having to think about it. Right? And you know where you are in space. Like riding a bike. It's totally non-conceptual, and you can spend a lot of time in that space. Listening to music, same thing.
Yeah, so these are all examples of non-conceptual experience through senses. And I think the reason why you're talking, using the example of body consciousness without confirmation by other senses, so to speak, is because that is like a particularly feels like it's particularly far from our conceptual framework. Whereas things like vision get immediately filtered into categories and this and that, right? The body consciousness
Consciousness
tends to
tends to
be
be
more
more
removed,
removed
feeling.
feeling. Yeah. Whatever we see or even hear often, at least my experience is I tend to label it pretty quickly. But that other thing, there's nothing to say really. It just I'm just there with it.
Okay,
Okay.
good.
Good.
So let's continue. If it is to be taken to be an implicative negation, so here we go with the whole system of there being two types of negation, implicative and non-implicative, right? If it is taken to be an implicative negation, the negation in the last paragraph was that things do not arise from themselves, which he said is to be taken as a simple negation. Doesn't imply that they arise from something, from some other scenario. So going back to our paragraph, if it is taken to be an implicative negation, then because that is predominantly affirmation. So if it were it's more like if it were mistaken to be an implicative negation, then because it's predominantly affirmation, it would be distinct from our doctrine, our way of doing things. This is so because that implicative negation would teach non-origination by affirming that dharmas are unoriginated. And he gives a scriptural support. So, does the footnote 86 have anything helpful? So, it is said in scripture, presumably in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, if one practices the non-origination of matter, and practices is a little bit of an odd translation for this. I would say more like brings about with the word experience as like understood the non-origination of matter. One does not practice the perfection of discernment. So he's saying that an implicative negation would have said, well, dharmas are not produced from themselves, and therefore they are unoriginated. So
I
that's it.
think the argument he's going to make is the implicative negation of is that if dharmas are not originated from themselves, therefore they must be originated from other.
Well, he gets to that finally, but I think he's saying here that there seems to be a significance in the wording going back to the opening of those eight qualities which are presented as without origination. He taught dependent origination without origination. He didn't say that dharmas are unoriginated, because that would assert that there are dharmas. For it is said, okay, so next paragraph. Here one should specify that entities do not originate from themselves. If one specifies otherwise, one would ascertain entities do not originate from themselves, rather, they originate from another. So that's what Chris was just getting at, that he's trying to avoid. He's very specifically avoiding creating that implicative, the implication that entities are originated from some other possibility by negating from themselves. Likewise, one would ascertain entities do not originate just from themselves, rather they originate from themselves and another, you know. So if you understand the negation of arising from self as implicative, then you think that there's some other option. Either it's from others or both or neither.
And this is generally his critique against the Prasanga method, that when you simply negate your opponent's thesis by showing its absurdity, you leave the door open for the contra thesis, the opposite of it, to be true.
Yeah, it's not complete in some sense. It's not thorough. You haven't like closed all the escape hatches thoroughly.
And many translators talk about Prasanga, translate Prasanga as reductio, the Western philosophical device, reductio ad absurdum, which is very often used to do that very thing, to show
Something
the
else.
opposite of the opponent's thesis.
Yeah.
And Jan Westerhoff pains himself to say that this is not a Prasanga is not reductio.
That was a huge point. That was a very important point he made. I've rarely seen that point made. That was good. So here's the structure of the syllogism. The thesis is that an ultimate reality is certain that the inner ayatanas do not originate from themselves. So, what are the inner ayatanas?
The eye, ear, nose, tongue, mind,
Right, the sense
body.
bases, the six sense bases. And what are the outer ayatanas?
The objects of those bases.
Right, together making 12. So there's this qualifier, which is an interesting insertion here by Bhavya in Ultimate Reality. I don't think we see Nagarjuna using that qualifier, which again is one of Bhavya's complaints. That Buddhapalita didn't clarify in which level of reality was being talked about. So here Bhavya is saying the structure of the syllogism about this point of the that dharmas do not arise from themselves and so forth. And he's using the inner ayatanas as an example. He says the proper structure should be, it is certain that in ultimate reality, it's certain that the inner ayatanas do not originate from themselves. So that's the subject is the inner ayatanas. And the premise or the predicate, the property to be proved is not originated from themselves. And the reason is because they exist. What a sense of humor, huh?
It's like, who is this going to convince? Like, you kind of have to already buy the argument to accept it,
You don't like that argument? Well, your ayatanas already exist, so how can you say that they originate from themselves? If they're there, then why would they originate further, Cynthia?
This is probably a really stupid question, but at the point in time that they're talking, those ayatanas already exist. But at some point in time during someone's life cycle, they had to be, or they arose through the formation of, whatever embryos and birth and all that process. So are they, what, I'm not sure, what are they only talking about right now during this argument? Or do they not? Where does the whole
Yeah,
process?
that's a great question. Anyone want to respond to that? What is the framework that's not explained here that provides the context for this thesis that Cynthia's getting at?
I'm still confused about the before he says in the ultimate sense that this is so, when it sounds like he's actually talking about just, relative reality. I mean, he's saying in ultimate reality, the ayatanas already exist. Isn't that what you just said?
That
That
is.
confuses me.
It's very
It's very
confusing.
confusing because no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no appearance. I mean, what does that mean then if these things are here?
I think
Think
the
the
answer
answer.
is thanks. Rob and I can't seem to speak at the same time. At the same time, without an echo, I think the answer, like if we read maybe to the end, it would help, and then we'll come back to that reason they exist already example. Like consciousness is one of the six. The objection: it's not been shown that the reason existence. Let's see.
And by the way, I realize my question Obviously, I was forgetting about that ultimate reality part that Rob just raised, because what I was describing obviously is more of a relative rather than ultimate situation, but.
So, I think what's not explained here is that he's responding to somebody who says this object is real, and so where did it come from? I think. And so he's saying, okay, if you think that there's real ayatanas that exist in ultimate reality, they can't originate from themselves because they already exist. If you accept that in ultimate reality there are things like ayatanas and other dharmas, he's like responding to somebody who's trying to assert that phenomena exist in ultimate reality, and the response to that is, well, if you think that things are ultimately real, then those ultimately real things, how did they come about? And so I think it's agreed, or it's stated, or understood that the opponent asserts that things ultimately exist. And so Bhavya is responding and saying, okay, in ultimate reality, certain that the ayatanas do not originate from themselves because you say they exist. Any other thoughts on that?
I think he's making this move in part to bracket it off from conventional thinking. He doesn't want to lose the ability to speak relatively and to, come across as being absurd. What do you mean things aren't caused? Of course they are. I made a cup of coffee this morning. What do you mean I didn't cause that coffee to be made? He wants to be able to preserve the ability to speak relatively, so he's putting this caveat at the beginning, in ultimate reality. I'm not talking about conventionality. We want to be really philosophically accurate here. And sort of dropping that object, the inner ayatanas, into a philosophical framework of very intense scrutiny.
But then, by saying they don't originate from themselves because they already exist, if we're talking in ultimate reality, I think we talked about this some other weeks. Why aren't they going straight to the heart of just not existing rather than talking about the cause?
Well, I think the starting point is that people think that things exist in truth, really. And so you
It's
sit.
sort of like if you're having an argument with someone who's so far gone, but you need to accept some of their premises for the sake of argument. So you could say, let's say for the sake of argument that the inner ayatanas exist. How could that be? How
Yeah,
could they be self-caused?
if they truly are existent, where did they come from? So,
And this is really, I think, where Chandrakirti is going to come after him, by him taking on his opponent's theses, for the sake of argumentation. He overcommits himself.
and so going back to Cynthia's statement, so there's some point one would accept that at some point there are no ayatanas, and then there are ayatanas. And as Chris said earlier, that's where he talks about refuting production from other, which obviously comes next. And so he's responding to people who have asserted that there's a potentiality for phenomena in in their predecessor, so to speak. Some matrix of reality gives rise to X, Y, or Z because X, Y, or Z exists in those, in that substrate or whatever, as a potential. And that's how things arise. They arise because they have some pre, like DNA, you know, it's like it's like an incorrect understanding of DNA, of like saying, well, a baby arises because the DNA, because that baby exists in the DNA of the sperm and the egg or whatever. It already exists there.
Or it's like the way we probably think of an acorn.
That a tree exists in the acorn.
That somehow there's a little blueprint there or something.
Yeah, there's a little blueprint that just gets bigger, right? So that's, he's working on production for himself. And it's a little odd that, he's supposed to be like presenting the more complete picture, but as it's clear from our discussion of it, it's a little odd that he doesn't provide this whole context. And it's sort of, I guess, to be understood, but so let's see. Because they exist already is the answer. So he doesn't explain that, well, if they did exist as a potentiality, then we all know the problems with that. And we've heard those a million times. But let's continue with the logical sequence, if we can bear it. Example, like consciousness, objection. It has not been shown that the reason, existence, is absent from dissimilar cases. So here we have an objector who knows the system of logical reasoning as well as Morgan does. And the way logical argument works is that a reason, a thesis, a syllogism, a logical syllogism, which includes the subject, the reason, and the reason is only supportable if the opposite of the reason exists in all cases of the opposite of the subject, if that makes any sense. In order to be ironclad in reasoning, you have to give a scenario where the reason applies to your subjects and the reason does not apply to the opposite of your subjects.
This is like a first pervasion or something like that.
It's called the perverse revasion. I mean, the reverse pervasion, right? So they have these technical structures of it. But I was trying to like explain it in a down to earth way. It's like your reasoning has to be all inclusive and all pervasive, ironclad, that this reason doesn't apply to any of the opposites. So the reason is it exists, and dissimilar cases would be anything other than Ayatanas, I imagine. Therefore, your syllogism lacks a valid reason. So that's the objector. Answer presumably is Bhavya, who says, because the similar cases simply do not exist. And dissimilar cases would be, it's a little bit unclear. There's no absence of the reason in that this non-existence is similar case. Therefore, here and in all similar syllogisms, there's no fault in not giving a dissimilar example. So he's saying, I can't give a dissimilar example. I think he reversed to what we initially thought was that, like, there's no real objects. See if the footnote helps at all. So, we didn't include this in the source book. Sorry about that, but here's the footnote.
No, it
Looks like.
is. I think it's here.
Oh, it is.
It's
All
not in the
right.
excerpt that Chris sent, but it's in the source book itself, I think.
Good.
Because
What
I'm looking
page do you?
at, I think,
Yeah.
93.
Footnote 93. So the opponent thinks that Bhav-viveka should give a dissimilar example. That is, an example of something that lacks the property to be proved. The property to be proved in our case is arisen from itself, right? And the proving property that lacks the property to be proved, and the proving property, in order to show that the reason is not present in cases where the property to be proved does not exist. Here, a dissimilar case would be something that originates from itself, opposite of the property to be proved. So it's the property, not the reason. I stated that it's has to apply to all the opposites of the property in all cases. Okay, so the property is arisen from itself, and the opposite is not originated. Something that originate, the similar case would be something that originate, that does originate from itself, and that does not exist already. Opposite of the proving property. For the Madhyamaka, there are no such cases, since nothing at all originates in ultimate reality. Which is sort of like going to the, using the Joker card, in poker or something, or like that's like your be all and end all reasoning, which is a little funny. But I think it's more like the similar case would be something that does originate from itself, but doesn't exist already, which is a non sequitur, right? How can it arise from itself if it doesn't exist already? That wasn't very convincing, I can see from your faces.
No, that was good. I think.
That's convincing, right? If it doesn't exist, then it can't arise from itself. So in order to arise from itself, it has to exist.
Even though it makes no sense to.
Even though it makes no sense. So in ultimate reality, phenomena do not originate from themselves, going back to our text, page 29, because they exist. If they don't exist, they can't arise from themselves. If they don't exist, they can't arise from themselves. And if they do exist, then there's no point in arising from themselves because they already exist. That's simpler, isn't it?
Does feel a little bit like a square peg in a round hole, like trying to positively form Madhyamaka. It's very clunky and awkward.
It is. It's incredibly clunky and awkward. I wonder if, like, for anybody, this was helpful.
Are there stories? I mean, with the Buddha, when he walked around and said a few words, and people were getting enlightened here and there and left and right, did that happen at all with Nagarjuna or these guys, or not
I
with
think in
them?
Nagarjuna probably, but I don't know of any stories to that effect. But certainly, I haven't heard any stories like that with Bhava-viveka.
It is interesting that he, is held in high repute still. For example, the Panchen Lama, who's, sort of second only to the Dalai Lama in the Gelug school, is one of his prior reincarnations is said to be Bhava-viveka. Bhava-viveka. So there's clearly they in
Yeah, they incorporate all of the guys, like there many of them are Shariputra incarnations and
Bodh-Gālayā.
and so
Sure, but
forth.
it shows that he's at least worthy of the same level of consideration as those guys.
Emily.
I'm also just remembering that in Kongtrul, Denmgun Kongtrul Lodro Tai's list of the different approaches you can take, he has Baba Viveka listed along with some other heavy hitters. I can find the quote, but I remember taking note of that he says this is a legitimate approach.
Yeah, he's totally highly regarded. Just not the pinnacle. Rob.
Yeah, I'm recalling how at the very top of this class, this was all about getting us to be non-conceptual. And it seems like it's been a real, like, conceptual dog chasing its tail now. So it seems a little counterproductive. I don't know. The negative part, when you have a non-implicative negation, you leave space. That's all that's left. Is space, which sort of sends the mind, you know, there's nothing to chew on. But this is asking you to chew. Seems to me.
So.
Well, I mean, you know, the prasinga approach seems to me is more like a koan.
Can I respond?
Sorry?
May I respond? Thanks. So. I think what the response to that is that if like you've read, we've together as a group, we've read Nagarjuna's first karika and opening paragraph, and did that produce non-conceptuality for you? Were you enlightened by it? Neither was I. So I think scheme, and I'll try to avoid using the words logic or reasoning because that's confusing. I think the idea behind it is that to actually produce non-conceptual wisdom requires you to understand fully the depths of conceptual construction. And that the depths of conceptual construction goes way deeper than just like a momentary gap produced by, like when we understand the non-implicative negation, like when we have that momentary gap of like, okay, so it's not that way, nor is it any other way. And we, you know, like looking, we've done the exercise of looking for the self, how the self relates to the skandhas over and over again. But clearly there's some deeper misconception that's holding us in samsara. And so the idea with the logical reasoning is to unpack that deeper confusion, that deeper ignorance, by going more deeply into what it is that we're ignorant about or confused by. And so there are different techniques for doing that. You know, we know in the Buddhist tradition that there are devotional techniques that are common. There's activity techniques such as, you know, later on there's prostrations, but earlier at this stage there's like circumambulating stupas, and pilgrimage were often techniques of just like exhausting one's whole structure. Ideally. And so this is like the exercise of intellectual exhaustion, and that it to get into it, it requires a huge effort of like understanding the intricacies of the logical system, and then the language, and then the whole setup, like who are we talking about, who we're responding to. So it like requires this intensely rigorous process of understanding that the Tibetan, like the Gelugpa system in particular, has inherited. Even though they claim to be Prasangika, they're the ones that perpetuate the logical reason in above Viveka more than any other school, strangely enough. Stranger than fact, stranger than fiction. And they have this, we've all seen the monks debating, but that's what they're doing. They're trying to really, it's like you exaggerate what is my conceptual construction of existence, and you make it real clunky, real like segmented in an intellectual way. And then you try to realize that, okay, I actually do hold these ideas that things are born from themselves. Like when I see a tree and an acorn, I'm like, yeah, the tree came out of the acorn. We actually do feel that way. And so, like, and then if I go, if somebody says to me, no, the tree didn't come out of the acorn, without saying anything else, I'll have a little gap, but I'll be like looking around for something else that came out. I don't know what's other people's takes on the Rob's very important questionnaire, Cynthia.
Well, I would just add to what you said about all the various techniques. The key point, I think, is to remember that it's because there are many different kinds of minds. And so the same technique does not work on every mind. So, like for some people, having some kind of non-conceptual experience, some kind of like the maha, the kashapa, the flower thing worked, for one guy, but not for everybody else in that room. Or on that mountain, or whatever. So I think it's that, we have to kind of remember that what works is not the same for everybody.
Yeah, so the general system in the Buddhist tradition up until this point had been absorption meditation. And we see that in texts up until this era, even in the Mahayana tradition, the use of the absorptions as the basis for then going into insight. And so there's that incredibly laborious process of developing jhana states. And then analysis based on that. So this is an alternate system that develops based on going right into the heart of the conceptual construction. What is conceptual construction? That whole term, prapancha, that idea that there's a net of conceptual construct that isn't busted open by jhana meditation. It's a very important concept of like this really hard egg. How are we going to crack open this egg? And it's like, so the tantric tradition is like, let's just crack it open, hit it with a hammer, and try to just, and that only works if it's ready, if you're ready. And then the other version is let's like understand what is keeping that egg intact. And I don't know. It's certainly not common to our tradition, and our version of Vipassana is dramatically, radically different than Vipassana in any other Buddhist tradition. I was thinking, let's see what Mary Beth says, and then let's see how he responds to Buddhapalita on the next page. Mary Beth.
So, would you just again say, Chris, the thing that you said in the beginning, where I think you were saying that maybe Bhavaveka was making an assumption that may not be true, something about that? Nagarjuna's intention to establish non-conceptual wisdom that's endowed with all cognizable objects by negating the net of all conceptual constructions. You made a point about that. Would you remind us again what that point was?
My point was that he is making the assertion that Nagarjuna was engaging in some sort of positive gesture of showing establishing a non-conceptual thingy by negating all conceptuality, and that doesn't necessarily follow that that's what Nagarjuna was doing.
Thank you.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a second. Like the idea of non-conceptual wisdom, I don't think appears anywhere in Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karaka, nor probably any of his other texts. I'm not sure if it's in his praise to Dharmadhatu. Or does he have a praise to non-conceptual? I wonder if he has a praise. But, you know, last year, I think in the fall, we did a course on a text by Maitreya called The Differentiation of Dharma and Dharmas. What was it? Dharmata, sorry. The Nature of Dharma and Dharmas. The Nature of Dharmas and Dharma by Maitreya. And the whole theme of that text was non-conceptual wisdom. And when I read this statement here about the non-conceptual wisdom, you know, I had never thought of Nagarjuna as that way, as like presenting non-conceptual wisdom. But it's like he's doing it in a non-applicative negation. He's like clearing away ignorance, and he doesn't state this is what I'm doing out there, and he doesn't state that there's non-conceptual wisdom that's going to arise naturally or appear or sort of manifest. But Maitreya does. And, you know, maybe that's partly why Bhava Viveka is mentioning it. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Why don't we take a peek at the interchange between Buddhapalita and Bhava Viveka? So on top of page 30, how about I'll be Buddhapalita, Chris, and you be Bhava? That's a setup, huh? So Buddhapalita comments, entities do not originate from their own selves because their origination would be pointless and because there would be no end to their origination. So that's like the simple negation, right? Sorry. You know, it's like, boom, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. And so that leaves you in that state of non-implicative negation. Okay, sorry.
It's like, it just one thought that keeps coming up for me, maybe because I'm totally sleep deprived. But it feels like Prasanga is like, it's like the punchline of a really good joke where like the whole conceptual lead up of it is just like exploded by the punchline. And you're just left like, what the heck was that? Anyway. Okay, now I'm Bhaviveka. This is not logically possible, because no reason and example are given, and because faults stated by the opponent are not answered. Also, because it is a prasanga argument, a property to be proved and a property which proves that, the opposite in meaning to that intended become manifest by reversing the original meaning. And then he's going to explain what that just meant. Specifically, the opponent could say that entities originate from another, because origination has a result and because origination has an end. Thus, Buddhapalita's own doctrine would be contradicted.
Okay.
So what I find so interesting is this, the opening, this is not logically possible, because no example are given, and because the faults stated by the opponent are not answered. Well, those aren't really logical issues. Those are issues in style, formal problems, you know, the way the argument is presented, not the argument itself.
Yeah, the word possible is the key word, right? is
Logically is in
not
brackets, which
possible.
means the translator added it, right?
Yeah. It's more like this is not logically defensible or logically sort of coherent.
Or like permissible in the game of logic that we're all, rules of the game we're all playing.
So I think he's attacking or talking about this part of Buddhapada's statement where he says, because their origination would be pointless. And that implies that there is origination. I don't know. But anyway, so that's their difference there.
But I think the latter, so I wrote down three different in my little margin here. I wrote down he's making three claims. First is that Buddhapada's argument is not in the form of a syllogism. The second is that it isn't directly addressing objections from other traditions. And that the third is that it leaves open for what we've called a reductio reversal, the implying the opposite of what he's saying.
That's great. Thank you for
And
that.
I thought that that set of three was just like a really good summary of his general problem with Buddhapalita.
So let's move on to the next part, which is about refuting production or origination from other, which starts on the same page here. I think it's in this section that below that says, thus, to begin with, entities, excuse me, do not originate from themselves. What does the phrase not from another, in parentheses, modify? The context is do any originated entities ever exist anywhere? From another means from something different. The full meaning of the negation is as before. So the negation is of production from other is similar to production from self. And here also the property of the subject that proves the thesis is manifest because the otherness of the other is the proving property. So interestingly, he focuses on the issue of otherness as being indefensible. Which it seems to me I've seen this part of the tetralemma, the four-sided situation, refuted in other ways than focusing on the indefensibility of the otherness of two dharmas. You can't say that they're other. Well, it actually resolves down to the more co most common one, which is that they don't exist at the same time, so they can't interact, right? And if they do, then the result already exists, and there's no purpose to the causation, right? The only way that it makes sense is if, on the one hand, if they meet, then the result already exists, and the cause doesn't do anything. And if they don't meet, then how can they possibly be any interaction between the two? But he focuses on how can phenomena be other? Any thoughts on that? Any reactions to that? So on the next page, well, actually, in the bottom, sorry. He says the syllogism is in ultimate reality, the inner ayatanas do not originate from their causal conditions, which is the explanation, the long explanation of other, which are different from them, right? And we went through the four causal conditions last time and the time before. Reason, because they are different from those causal conditions. That's the reason that they do not originate from them, because they're different. Just as a jar is different from the causal conditions of the inner ayatanas, and so does not originate from them, which is a little bit of an odd example, because the disconnect between jars and ayatanas is a little more distant. Alternatively, one can state the following syllogism. In ultimate reality, it's certain that the alleged, I like that, causal conditions that bring about the inner ayatanas, the eye and so on, and which are different from them, are not causal conditions of the inner ayatanas. Reason, because they are different. Example, just as threads are different from the inner ayatanas, and so are not their causal conditions. Threads are about as different from ayatanas as jars are.
Yeah, you'd think it would be more effective if he suggested a thing that could purportedly be a cause.
Yeah, something that you would think would be a cause, right? Like light or color or something like that.
Energy.
So on the bottom of the page, he expounds on his what he's getting at. He says that the objection from the Vaisheshikas is not good. The cause of the cognition of difference, otherness, is just the establishment of the general property of difference. This is so because our reason, because they are different, is stated in general, and also because the consideration of whether that difference is a quality or something else is a different consideration. Then he goes into this whole discussion of qualities as being possessed by a phenomena. Let's see. Then he continues, moreover, so 32, the Vaisheshikas, so they're the atomists from among the different Indian philosophical schools. Their atomic theory does not hold an ultimate reality, because in ultimate reality, atoms of earth do not produce the substance called earth. Now, this is a better one, because you would think that atoms of earth produced earth, right? The reason, because they're atoms. It's a little bit of a comedy routine. At some point, you got to see the humor in it, right? Like atoms of fire. One should say that atoms of fire also do not produce the substance fire. The Abhidharmaka say, if your reason difference is stated about things that are empty of the power to produce the result, then the meaning of your reason is not established. That's a very convoluted statement. I think they're getting at that the otherness of atoms of earth and earth is not proven.
Are atoms of earth assumed to be existing?
By the Vaisheshikas. I think he's accepting them. I'm not sure.
Right. So essentially, there's the idea that there are such things as atoms of earth, but then the idea here is
and there's earth.
Do not produce earth. So then what does it mean to call something an atom? I mean, that seems like it sort of denies, it either denies the idea that something could be an atom of earth.
I think he's saying that simple objects can't produce complex objects.
Which means that it's meaningless to say that there's an atom of earth.
It's meaningless to say there's anything other than an atom of earth.
But what
I guess it could go either way.
It's
It's meaningless to say that, like,
meaningless all the way
I
down.
mean, going back to the chariot example, right? Like, it's meaningless to say there's a chariot. There's only the components of the chariot. It's meaningless to say there's a handful of earth. There's only atoms of earth. They can't cause something because they already exist. But what I find very interesting about this is because it feels like the reason is there's a whole lot implied in the reason because they are atoms, which right now we're trying to unpack, that you would think he would be unpacking himself for us. It's really requiring a lot of work on behalf of the reader to make sense of these arguments. And I wonder if part of it is because is maybe restrictions of on the syllogism itself, and maybe part of it is that he's really trying to avoid writing the prasanga part, writing that this would lead to this absurd conclusion.
Yeah, it's sort of mysterious, and I'm like dying to see if there's commentaries on Bhavi-veka that like
There
make sense of
was
this.
one that's very, very long, and I think it's the longest text in the Tengyur, but we don't have an English translation of it. I tried to
Right,
find it
I
for this
meant if there
class.
were any English commentaries.
Yeah. Sorry.
There's a life project for someone to do.
Yeah, really.
Can we
Just this
get
like
84,000
one
on it?
first chapter. If somebody could just do this one, focus on this first karika of Nagarjuna's and how it's responded to by these two guys would be really cool. A comparison of it, which is what we're trying to do. So, somebody here want to do that, Emily? Anyway, just to
Haha, maybe someday.
he then gives a very bizarre situation. Okay, so t towards the bottom of 32, Buddhapology gives the very simple reasoning that we're all very familiar with. It's interesting to find that, like, we know Buddhapology's line of reasoning. It's like that's what's come down to us, right? His is entities also do not originate from other because it would follow that everything would originate from every other thing, from everything, right? It would be totally haphazard. If things arose from something other, then there's no rhyme or reason, and things would just spontaneously arise all over the place from other things. And that's the reasoning that we've all heard that comes down to us when we study Madhyamaka at this time. So it's clearly like his simplicity and clarity has stood the test of time. Bhava's critique, therefore, because there was a prasanga argument in your commentary, then having reversed, blah, 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 it goes into the technical, logical, syllogistic thing. One could say that entities originate from themselves or from both or from no cause because some particular thing originates from some particular thing. Then your previous position would be contradicted. So it's not like an ironclad statement that covers all bases from a logical point of view. Otherwise, if such an alteration of the blah, 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 because it would follow that everything would originate from everything, would be neither a proof nor a refutation on the top of 33, and therefore your argument would be incoherent in meaning. And then he quotes this amazing verse, right? It would be like this following incoherent verse. And like, where does he get this from? 139. Anyone figure out where he got this from? Well, anyway, Okay, well, that's good. So with certain grasses, certain creeper and the tamarind are beneficial for fever. These must be like sort of common knowledge things, right? There's nothing charming about harlots. Harlots, what a weird word, right? What does that mean? Bamboo shoots are heavy in the stomach. And blah, blah, blah. The rays of the moon are cool in the hot season. Total non sequiturs. And then the footnote, so 139, says, according to Avalokita Vrata, who is the author of the longest text in the collected works of India, as Chris was just talking about, his commentary on this text. The idea is that Buddha Pada's argument is incoherent if left as it stands because, one, the origination of everything from everything does not prove that entities do not originate from another. Like, that's an example, like, that things could originate from everything. That's an example. It's not a proof. It's not a reason, right? It's a logical, it's a conclusion. What's it called? A reductio absurdum sort of type of result.
Well, sort of taking it to the extreme.
Take it, that's it. Thank you. Does not prove that, right? Two, the origination of everything from everything is not, in fact, a property of entities. Nothing arises from everything, right? You know, he says, well, then everything would arise from everything. And Bhava is saying, no, it's not, in fact, a property of entities. You can't find any example of anything that's arisen from everything. Because of one, there's no connection between Buddha Pada's thesis and his reason, just as there's no connection between the lines of the verse quoted.
I think Buddha Pada would be like, yeah, dude, that's the point.
Okay. So the Samkhya say a result such as a sprout originates from its causal factors that are distinct from it and from a causal factor that is not distinct from it. In the case of a sprout, these two kinds of causal factors have the characteristics of soil, etc., and a seed, respectively. Right, so that's what we all believe causation works with, right? That there's a primary cause, the acorn turns into the tree with the assistant conditions of moisture and soil and sunlight, right? And the answer, because they think that entities originate from both themselves and others, therefore to them, Nagarjuna says the following. So he shifts to the third option of, you know, the phenomena arise from both themselves and others, which is what the Samkhyas are saying in this statement. And he quotes Nagarjuna as saying, not from both, instead of saying, not from both themselves. So that's what he means. Anyway, we're out of time, which might seem like a good thing in this case. But I think we've dipped our toe in the world of Bhavya. And it's interesting to see the way he responds to the situation. Mostly because we know the plot later on, over the next 1,000 years or whatever, 1,500 years. But from here, he moved to Chandrakirti. And I'm really sad I'm not going to be here next week to hear about Chandrakirti. So I look forward to listening and seeing what you all come up with. What do we have first? Is it the Prasanapada or the Madhyamaka avatar? can't remember. Probably the Prasanapada. Well, should we dedicate our merit? Did our merit arise from itself or from the activity of contemplating the Dharma? By this merit may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness and death from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings by the confidence of the golden sun of the great east. May the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Derek.
Thanks, everyone, for persevering. Have a great week and see you in a while.
And just to clarify what we've got for next week, we've got Chandrakirti's Madhyamakavatara. And then we have our old friend Jan Westerhoff's commentary from a fairly recently published book on that. So we'll have a lot to look forward to, as I, Derek has just reminded me, will be teaching the class without him. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you. Have fun. Take care. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.